Good morning. This is April 4th meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will come to order. We have four bills on the agenda. And we're going to start with Senator Dibble, House File 3613, which this committee has seen before and passed before. But it's coming back here. It was a bill that simply put in a effective date that was missed several years ago. But the reason it's back here is Senator Kunesh has an amendment with an effective date to speak to. So I guess, Senator Kunesh, you're going to present the bill amendment or whatever. Senator Dibble, who wants to go first, if either of you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of the Vanna White here, so.
Thank you. Members, I have here the A24 amendment. And this amendment simply adds the implementation date to the education finance bill.
And Senator Pappas moves the A24 amendment, which I believe is in the packets.
It is.
Okay. Is there any discussion of the A24 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator, I guess this was not an author's, it's an amendment the author wanted, but could you just explain briefly what this was needed for?
When we presented the forecast bill to you earlier a couple weeks ago, we forgot to put in the implementation date to pay for the school lunches and breakfasts, and so this simply adds that implementation date.
So, and this is one, again, the MMB said they couldn't deal with it unless we had the effective date in, even though it said in the bill that fiscal year 2024 money is being shifted. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Is there a further discussion? Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if somebody from MMB could explain why we didn't catch this when it came through originally.
Does anybody from MMB wish to be able here to speak to that? Okay, we don't know anyone from MMB is here right now. And Mr. Nauman, did you have any comments on it slipping through or?
Not a great level of comment, but I will say we all feel like we have a little bit of egg on our face, and it's important to fix the law so that it operates correctly and MMB can make payments.
Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a brief editorial here. You know, this this Metro Mobility forecast change was included in both the November and the February forecast on the expectation it would be passed quickly. We're more than a month past the February forecast, and this bill still hasn't passed. I still continue to be concerned with the adjustments made to forecast on the promise that we're going to pass legislation, and here we are without legislation passed. It's nice that Senator Kunesh had a vehicle bill to attach this to, but it just shows that I think we need to take a second look at how we do the forecasting and make sure that we comply with state statute.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Is there further discussion? If not, Senator Pappas moves that House File 3613 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, no discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Kunesh.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senate File 4936, Senator Hochschild, Tax Forfeited Land Settlement Account Establishment. This is for the Tyler case, and I'm going to have, we don't usually have a lot of testimony in the Senate Finance Committee, but this is a bill that's referred to initially to the Finance Committee, and because of the nature of this bill, we're going to be having testimony, and so we have Liz Kramer, the Solicitor General, who's going to be speaking here after this. And then we have a couple of people from the counties who are going to speak as well. And we have others here who will be able to answer questions as we go. So with that, Senator Hochschild, can you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Finance Committee. Today I have for your consideration Senate File 4936, a bipartisan bill related to tax forfeited lands. I also have the A9 amendment, Mr. Chair.
A9 amendment, Senator Pappas moves the A9 amendment, which is in the package. This is first committee, so it's the form of an author's amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill as amended by the A9 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As many of you may know, the U.S. Supreme Court released a consequential ruling last spring stating that Minnesota's system of tax forfeiture was unconstitutional because in cases where tax-forfeited land sales resulted in excess of the total property taxes and obligations due at the time of the forfeiture, state law did not direct those funds back to the property owners. Instead, statute directed payments of certain property interest and then the use of the funds for public purposes, including a distribution to all local taxing districts, This bill is specifically focused on creating a framework to settle damages of individuals impacted by past unconstitutional takings, addressing our state's liability, looking back in time, and to support a settlement process that has been constructed and agreed to by the class action plaintiffs representing individuals that would stand to benefit from the settlement process, as well as county governments and the state, including the Attorney General's office. Members, as we continue to discuss this important piece of legislation this morning, I'm hoping we can share the following sentiments. Firstly, that we have an obligation to fix our broken system and to try to provide relief to those residents and individuals impacted in an expeditious, fair, and transparent manner. Secondly, that counties were following state statute and administering this process on behalf of the state. We cannot and should not abandon our partners for following through on their statutory directives. The bill in front of you today keeps both of those principles front and center. I want to thank Senator Chair Marty, Senator Pratt, and many others for their willingness to dive into this issue, recognizing its complexities and despite the undesirable position we may find ourselves in. In closing, I believe that this is an issue that requires immediate attention and does not get easier or cheaper with time. My hope is that this settlement will bring closure to the negative impacts of the old forfeiture system while also laying out a responsible way forward to pay for our obligations and make sure that it doesn't come back on local communities and residents. Thank you, Chair Marty and committee members for your time. And I do have, like you mentioned, the Solicitor General, Liz Kramer, as well as two testifiers from St. Louis County. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kramer, welcome to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you all for having me. My name is Liz Kramer. I'm our State Solicitor General, and I'm here this morning to share the context of this Senate File 4936, which, as Senator Hauschild said, resolves significant class act litigation against the state and all of its counties. In May of last year, the United States Supreme Court held in a unanimous decision that one aspect of Minnesota's tax forfeiture law was an unconstitutional taking. In particular, it was the aspect of Chapter 282, which required the government to keep any surplus it received from selling a tax-forfeited property for more than the amount due. Under that statute, the counties who sold the property were able to keep only a portion of those surplus funds and had to give the majority to cities and school districts. That statute in question, which is Section 282.08, was passed in 1935. So for over 80 years, no one had challenged it, and we are all here today trying to resolve a problem that is not of any of our making. But after the Supreme Court decision in that Hennepin County case, two more class actions were filed very quickly. One against the state in all 87 counties and another specific to St. Louis County. In all of these actions, plaintiffs are looking to recover their surplus proceeds, plus, of course, interest on that money and attorney's fees. Now, because of that Supreme Court ruling in Tyler, there really wasn't room to contest liability. We entered into settlement talks with the plaintiff's counsel right away in hope of keeping costs to the state down and getting class members their money quickly. Our estimate was that if plaintiffs had been successful with their various arguments in court, a judge could have entered judgment against the state well in excess of $500 million. As you know, we negotiated that amount down to $109 million, which is what the bill reflects. Under this bill, the owners of about 6,000 properties all over the state will be able to recover up to 90% of their surplus plus interest on that amount. We negotiated a term sheet with plaintiffs and signed it at the end of February, and we're working on an over 50-page settlement agreement that ties up all the minutiae of that. This bill does two things. It funds the settlement but it also addresses a separate topic, which is how counties will help contribute to the settlement amount. That issue, to be clear, is not part of the settlement agreement with plaintiffs. But counties largely stopped selling their tax forfeited property when the U.S. Supreme Court became interested in this issue because nobody knew how to constitutionally sell a property at that point. So there's quite a bit of inventory, over 2,500 properties in inventory. And this bill requires that counties make a good faith effort to sell those and put the majority of the proceeds back in state coffers. And we estimate that will garner between $20 and $30 million. I'm happy to answer questions later. Thank you very much.
Questions from members of the committee? Senator Friends and Senator Champion.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for testifying today. And perhaps, you know, a couple questions that I have that you're able to answer. If not, then I'll certainly ask cities and counties, because I definitely want to ask them some questions. Based on your work on this case, was counties keeping record of the sales of properties? And if so, were we able to determine from those records how many of these properties were sold where there were actually surpluses that counties and cities received as a result of taking individuals' property?
Senator Champion, could you speak a little closer to the microphone, too? Ms. Kramer, go ahead.
I did hear it. Senator Marty, thank you. Senator Champion, we were happy to realize that all counties are keeping good records. One thing that made negotiation of the settlement difficult is there was no statewide database of all these tax-forfeited properties. So every county was keeping their own records properly, but had no reason to share them with each other. So I will give a lot of credit to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which did really the work of compiling all these statewide figures from all the counties. But yes, we have enough data that we can determine where there was what we're calling a presumptive surplus and where an individual then can be a member of this class.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Champion, please.
So can you share with me what will be the process that would be used by counties and cities and others to notify individuals of the settlement and the potential opportunity for them to recover?
Ms. Kramer, go ahead.
Senator Champion, the notice will not come from the cities and the counties, but from a claims administrator. So our settlement agreement provides that there will be a third party who is an entity that is a professional in handling large class actions like this. And that entity, the claims administrator, will receive all this data we've collected from the counties about these roughly 6,000 properties, who were the owners at the time, and you know, any information we have about where they may be now. And that entity, and the judge, so Chief Judge Castro in Ramsey County, will approve the actual form of the notice that will go out. And so the claims administrator will send the notice and try and follow up and make sure that all affected homeowners or property owners receive this information and have an opportunity to come forward.
Senator Champion, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. Where I'm a little concerned is what will happen if, let's say for an example, I think that there's a time period, and if there's been any unfortunate passings of an owner and maybe property did not get probated, or if it did, I'm concerned about how that family will still receive the information that they need. Here's my other question. Under this agreement, I recognize by looking at the amendment that has been put forward, the A9, and I'm looking specifically at lines 2.6 through 2.8, that it talks about the settlement and surplus proceeds from the sale of the tax forfeited land and mineral rights in those lands. So I'm assuming because this 282 was deemed unconstitutional, that you've had some conversations with cities and counties about how they will deal going forward, even outside of this settlement agreement because it only covers a certain amount of time. What information has you provided or has the Attorney General's office provided cities and counties about how they should behave going forward? Because Ms. Tyler is just a representation of a number of individuals whose land was taken, surplus proceeds were available. Those proceeds did not go to that particular person. But what advice have you given them around how they should make sure that they're not violating the law going forward?
Ms. Kramer, go ahead.
Senator, I think you're raising a really important point, which is there's two things that need to happen to really resolve the whole unconstitutional taking situation. This part is making people whole for the amount of surplus properties that was inappropriately kept by the government. But the second part is the statute needs to change. And I understand that your colleagues are working on that. And so I have not felt the need to give any special guidance to cities and counties because I understand that the legislature is going and is committed to fixing the statute to make sure it complies with the Fifth Amendment going forward.
And Mr. Chair, to Senator Hochschild, then Senator Hochschild, tell us what you're doing in order to make sure that we're not just covering the settlement, but we are preventing taking that may potentially happen by cities and counties going forward, because these are real people whose property is being taken and families whose inheritances are being challenged. What work are you doing in order to help us avoid this going forward? And why wasn't that a part of this settlement agreement in order for us to know exactly how that law should be changed?
Mr. Chair, Chair, Senator Champion, a really important point you're making, and I have been involved on the periphery with Senator Westland's work on the forward-looking policy provision to statute that Ms. Kramer just mentioned, but I am not the lead person on that policy bill that is also moving through the legislature right now. So I don't want to answer without enough information. And if Chair Marty had something else to say, certainly welcome that.
Senator Champion, Senator Westland is working on this, as are many others in the counties and so on are involved. And I think we want to make sure that we don't have this kind of problem in the future and get the law fixed. And I think they're working on that now. I'm not sure the exact status in the last week, but it is going to move forward.
And one last thing, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chair, maybe it's more of a comment as opposed to a direct question, and maybe I'll wait until the cities and counties come up. But what troubles me about this is the fact that this law has been in existence for quite some time, and cities and counties have been operating under this law knowing that they were sometimes taking property from others and there was surplus profits available or surplus money available, and never coming to the state, at least from my knowledge, and to say, hey, I think you should change this because we're seeing some inequitable things happening in our counties and in our state, specifically also Hennepin County, my county. They've been deeply embedded in this practice, and because they were getting revenue, that no one came as a part of their legislative agenda and said, this is something that I think should be changed because it's just inequitable. And so I wait until the counties come up because I think they should have a lot of explaining, because I don't know why counties didn't request a change in the law to avoid these inequitable practices. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Friends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Hochschild. Thanks, Ms. Kramer. I think what you've done here is good work to try to take a situation and get a resolution and let the state move forward. I'm going to cut about half my remarks and agreeing with my colleague here by saying it's not just where we've been, but where we're going. And we have to look back to say, how do we avoid this in the future? And just a quick nod, Senator Hochschild, to your comment about the counties as our partners. Of course, here at the legislature, we like successful partnerships. And for my friends in the counties, partnerships are two-way streets. We want to be there for the counties. We want to support them. We want the counties to help keep us informed, to let us know what's going on, and that includes the good and the bad. Looking forward to continuing that partnership. And that includes the $109 million, where weren't expecting to come up with $109 million a couple of years ago. Now here we are, and looking forward to partnering with the counties going forward on the money as well as the policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Kramer, could you speak to the committee briefly about how comprehensive this is? Does the state still liable? In which cases might the state be liable? What's the risk to the state if this settlement goes through?
Thank you, Chair. My expectation is that this $109 million resolves the great majority of liability. I can't say that there's never any risk that someone would come forward with a really old claim. So let me back up and say that the settlement agreement, based on agreement with plaintiff's counsel, covers folks up 7 years before each of the three cases was started. And that's why you see in the legislation three different time periods covered. But so that covers 6,000 people. That's a lot of people. It is possible that someone whose property was tax forfeited, say 20 years ago or 15 years ago, could come and bring a case against the state. We can't stop that from happening. But in an instance like that, we would have strong bases to dismiss that case based on both the statute of limitations that applies and potentially this settlement agreement.
Thank you. Are there other questions from members of the committee? Senator Pratt, then Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kramer. When we spoke yesterday, you kind of talked about the path and the legal decisions that were made along the way. Can you maybe summarize those just briefly for the committee? You were talking about the decisions made at the appellate level until it got to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, okay.
Please go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Marty. Mm-hmm. Senator Pratt, this case, the Tyler case in particular, the one against Hennepin County, started in federal district court. And to be clear, the county won. The federal district court dismissed these claims. And at the Eighth Circuit also affirmed that decision, finding that the Tyler claims were not viable under some previous case law. And so it was really a change in what everybody understood the law to be on takings in this type of context when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, especially to have that unanimous ruling.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is a question for you or the counties, but is Minnesota the only state that had this law in the books?
Ms. Kramer.
No, Senator Pratt. There are a number of states who are going through similar things to us. In particular, Michigan had similar statutes and is resolving a number of large class actions about that. Nebraska is in a similar situation. Those are the only states that come to mind, but I recall that there were about 12 that had similar statutes.
Thank you. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Solicitor. And I guess Senator Hochschild, maybe start with you. Senator Champion talked about the other provisions, and there's no provisions in here fixing this going forward. So why are these issues not conjoined moving through the process together? Because if we put the money out there, the statute doesn't get fixed, everybody's in limbo. And so why aren't we moving these together? And then I have some follow-ups.
Chair Marty, Senator Westrom, the purpose of doing this bill in particular, I can't necessarily speak for the other bill that Senator Westland is working on, but the point of this was really to settle the settlement, to make sure that we were whole on what the settlement was. So we're focusing on that. We're coming up with a process to make sure that money is distributed. The policy looking forward was just considered sort of another effort that needed to be moved forward as well. So both are moving forward. It's just that we have a sort of a fiscal bill and a policy bill.
And Senator Westrom, on that point too, this one, in order for the settlement to move forward, we have to have the money in by June. If the other one didn't pass this year, I think the counties are just going to hold the property because they don't, otherwise they're at risk for doing something unconstitutional. So I have a feeling, I mean, we've got to pass it this year. I think we should pass both bills this year.
Mr. Chair, next question, but you're kind of making my point. The idea of sending out $109 million out the door, and not having the fix in. It's kind of like bandaging up a wound with a nice big bandage, but you don't take out the infection. And you've got the infection in the statute that was allowing takings or promoting takings. Why this has taken so long for people to figure this out on its face, it seems like we should have been looking at this and realizing this would be in violation of the takings clause of the Constitution. So it's a little bit backwards, I think, that we're talking about this. But Senator Hochschild or Solicitor, I think you sort of answered the question, but how much of this money did the state get and how much of the money did the counties keep in these processes? My understanding is the counties kept most all of the money, if not all of it, and why would the state be paying for the counties that got money already?
Ms. Kramer, you want to speak to that? Or do you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Marty. Senator, that's an important question. I'm glad you asked. The statute specified what the counties were to do if there was any surplus, so they didn't have discretion over that. The statute allowed them to keep 40%, and the other 60% was split between school districts and the local city or town. But your broader question of why is the state involved has a couple of responses. The first is it was a state statute that counties were following. They weren't just going rogue out there on their own, taking people's excess property and distributing it. But also, technically, when the property is forfeited, the title was taken in the name of the state of Minnesota. So there really was a moment where the state held the property.
Mr. Chair, Solicitor, the state didn't receive any of that money, and counties that did more of this received more money, correct?
Ms. Kramer.
The answer to your question is actually a little bit complicated by the cost of the overall schemes, and this might be a better question for the counties, but I'll say I have seen the analysis that a number of the counties have done, and most properties don't sell with any what we're calling surplus here. Most properties sell at a loss, where the sale price is less than the taxes owed and the investment the county had to make in just maintaining the property and keeping it secure, et cetera. So there are some properties with a surplus, and that's what we're talking about today. But in the past, that surplus helped just balance out all the other properties and help keep the system afloat.
Mr. Hilgert, do you want to speak to it briefly as well?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of 87 counties, and I think the Solicitor General did a wonderful job talking broadly of that theory. And I think in practice what this means is, I'll give you an example of Stearns County. If you pick one year, 2013 is the recent books that I've seen for Stearns County. They had around 15 properties that were forfeited to the state. Remember what this means, forfeiture. In Minnesota, the court didn't rule that our process wasn't generous in its time or anything like that. In fact, if you look at other states, what happens in Minnesota is if I don't pay my taxes for a year, I have 3 years to get current. In addition to that, I have multiple opportunities to enter payment plans that can extend that for 10 years. We're not Illinois, where we sell these debts to private companies to collect. We're not other states with short redemption periods. In fact, our redemption periods protect homeownerships, and we should continue doing that. And to your question on what are we going to do in the future, that will be part of that process. However, to the cost of this process, once this property forfeits to the state, the counties then get it. We have to maintain it, and we might invest significant properties. Everyone here represents a community that might have one of these properties in it, where it's dilapidated, it's blighted, it might be a security threat. You might be receiving calls from your constituents about an abandoned property, and the county would have to take efforts to board those up, to clean them, to take out asbestos and remove mold remediation, or in some cases, demolish the entire property itself. So getting back to the Stearns County case, of the 15 properties that forfeited in that particular year. 10 of those properties were huge losses to the county. They were cleaning it up, they were demolishing it. The total amount of property taxes owed, interest, fees, et cetera, were far beyond what they were able to sell it at open market. So the taxpayers took a loss. Your neighbors, your residents were basically, in effect, paying disproportionately to maintain those properties. The five properties that were sold at some kind of a net profit, anywhere ranging from $50 to, I think I saw, $5,000. Yes, there was a profit there, but those surplus were put back into the remediation efforts of the other 10. And by no means did that five properties that held those profits ever come close to the actual costs of what this mandate is for your local communities. And so to the Solicitor General's point, for most counties, this is a very clear, not only loss, but a significant loss in terms of government revenue and what taxpayers are paying to actually run this process on behalf of the state.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Hilgard. I mean, there's lots of things that we need to be have our eyes open to this in this process, but to just your last point, the fact that property taxes could get so high that in a few years of delinquency, it's more than the property is worth, also underscores the problem we have with the property tax evaluation, because property that's paying that kind of property taxes should never be that close to being underwater just in a few years of property tax delinquency. And so you see the irony of this problem. I mean, somebody's assessing and taxing these properties too high when you've got this outcome. And so we need to take note of this and realize that this system is probably broadly broken, not just unconstitutional, but broadly broken. If you've got assessments, and I hear from people with assessment complaints all the time, and them trying to solve something with the county is like getting a mule to move in the pen when he doesn't want to move. And so I hope we take this opportunity to actually fix the problems that are with our property tax system, but overtaxation is one of them, because you can't have fair taxes if the property that is being foreclosed on in just a few years of delinquency is worth a lot less or some less than what the property tax is, because they're supposed to only be about 1% of the valuation, more or less. And so does anybody else see this problem with property taxes if this is the case? And so but back to the issue at hand, to not be sending the policy change with the money, Mr. Hilgard, why aren't we fixing it all at the same time here?
Mr. Hilgard, anyone want to respond?
Mr. Chair, I think
we're working on both. I
answered that question. Okay. Yeah.
But Mr. Chair, so what I'm hearing is we're going to send the money out the door with the promise that we'll fix the rest.
Senator Westrum, the thing is, I don't think any of the counties are going to be selling property until they know how to deal with it, which means we have to fix the law. So this is a fixing the past cases. There aren't going to be new ones until we have a new law.
And so to those questions, Mr. Chair, Solicitor, and maybe you're the best one to answer this, you talked about it a little bit. Is there a statute of limitations on constitutional rights? Do you think, that was my first instinct too, that there'd probably be a statute, and that's why you went back 7 years, but more I'm thinking about this, can legislatures take, which statute of limitations are a device of the legislative bodies that put them in place. Can we put a statute of limitations on a constitutional takings case?
Ms. Kramer.
Chair Marty, thank you. Senator Westrum, yes, there are statute of limitations on various constitutional rights. They vary,
okay,
you know, as to what the right is. The broad answer is yes, the legislature can do that.
And so, Mr. Chair, Solicitor, is that why we picked 7 years? Is that the furthest back we feel there's a statute of limitations that people could have a challenge? Or how did the 7 years prior to 2019 come into to play, and you talked about possibility of somebody 15 or 20 years ago might be able to bring a claim. Can you kind of explain that a little bit more?
Yes, thank you. There is no specific Minnesota statute that sets a limitation period for an unconstitutional property taking like this. And so we were faced with a variety of arguments. The plaintiffs had a non-frivolous argument that the period was 15 years, although no case had applied that 15-year period. And we had a non-frivolous argument that the time period was 1 year. And so essentially we met roughly in the middle at 7 years in order to compensate a good number of people in understanding that we felt a court was likely to land around there.
Solicitor, you talked about the 2,500 properties more or less that the counties are in limbo with right now or holding. Is that part of the 6,000 number you're talking, or is that an additional class or number of properties that are above the 6,000 that were in the estimated from 2019 to 7 years prior?
That is part of the 6,000, Senator.
That's it for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Before we go to Senator Champion, we have two witnesses from St. Louis County who are going to testify. Senator Champion, is your question for
Mr. Hilgarth?
Oh, for Mr. Hilgarth. Well, can we have the county come up in, because they're going to explain some of this process too quickly, and then we'll take your question
that'd
from Mr. Hilgarth or whoever.
And Mr. Chair, I can ask my question, so once they
sure.
finish.
Sure, why don't you go ahead, yes.
No, I'm just saying once they finish, because I have to leave if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
So if we can have Mr. Hilgarth come back up. Mr. Hilgarth, I was listening to your testimony, and I would take it that you are very passionate about this, which I believe that you should be, but I want to consider your analogy that you said if you look at 15 properties, 10 are losses, 5, there would be some, and I think you used the word net profit on those, and then you went into what I would consider some considerations that the county has to think about, which is losses, the taxpayers are paying for this, and you went into that. So can you share with me what impact does the county's actions have on the 5 families whose property was taken, and then there is this surplus, and we know that usually property is the threshold to building wealth. So it sounds like to me like there's wealth stripping. So help me understand if there's anything on the other side of the equation, as you talked so eloquently about the county's challenges. What about the individual folks who make up your county, and those 5 whose net profits, as you articulated, was taken?
Mr. Hilger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, you hit the nail on the head. That's what the Supreme Court said is unconstitutional, very clearly and very firmly in a 9-0 ruling. It doesn't matter the fact to which I said earlier that the county had the state has a very generous redemption process. It doesn't matter about the off-ramps to a 10-year payment plan. It doesn't matter to the fact that our notice periods and our publication and our transparency about this process to the taxpayer is so much clearer than other states. It doesn't matter that counties take it upon themselves to actually build home affordability programs, offer programs themselves to try to keep people in their home, that we have the senior property tax deferral program and credits that we come to the legislature every year asking for you to fund, or that the county themselves are trying to contact the counties above and beyond their statutory responsibilities to say, hey, you're sitting on equity, please sell this yourself. In fact, the Supreme Court noted in their decision, even in the decision, they weren't able to find out why why Ms. Tyler did not sell her property after all the notification and efforts that went into it. At the end of the day, those efforts don't matter, and the Supreme Court agreed with exactly what you're saying. It doesn't matter what your intent is to preserve home ownership. It doesn't matter what you do and what you spend outside of your levy your tax forfeited budget to try to help people stay in their homes. At the end of the day, you cannot. The statute is broken that allows you to take any of that excess, no matter your noble goals for the rest of the properties or what you do with that excess. You're right on.
And one last question, Mr. Hilgarth, I've seen you around the Capitol here, and you are eloquent when you want to talk about the issues for the county. Can you recall any time that you or your county has come to the state and said this 80-year statute that's in place that seemed to strip individuals of their wealth should be changed because it's just inequitable? Can you tell me if you all ever had that as a priority?
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, I've been around for 8.5 years at the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's been an honor to serve the 87 counties in that time. The issues that I've been impacted in this issue, on this particular issue of tax forfeiture, has been asking the state for a few things. One, the senior property tax deferral program, which basically allows, especially seniors who are susceptible to cases like this, to basically say, if you can't afford your property taxes, we will pay it. The state will pay on behalf of you. Don't worry, stay in your property. That's been on an AMC priority for 5 years, and last year we advocated for that. Senator Klein actually successfully passed a bill that would expand that program. That's one. The second thing we've done, and I think Senator Westrum or perhaps Senator Dames and Weber have carried this piece before, which is to say this entire process costs property taxpayers a ton of money right now. Remediation, cleanup, etc. This is not a money-making business. And so we asked the state for support to actually help your communities pay for some of these properties for cleanups. That has not successfully been funded. The third thing is legal aid last year, Senator Champion. We worked with Mr. Ron Elwood to actually reduce the amount of interest and penalties that people pay on their delinquent taxes. To Senator Westrum's point earlier, the state sets the delinquency rates. Last year, we were successful actually making that a flexible rate because Hennepin County, your county is actually wanting to charge little to none. And I think this gets to the point which I'm most passionate about is what are we doing next? AMC has created a tax forfeiture work group that has been working for almost a year entirely, throughout the summer, throughout the interim, working with ARP, working with legal aid, working with others to say how do we create the new system that is a model for states that preserves our strong redemption period, our strong commitment to home ownership, make sure that excess is delivered back promptly to property owners, and make sure that this wrong that was committed is righted, and that we make sure we never deviate from that path in the future. And that, Senator Champion, is what my passion is. This bill is critically important. It's one of those two facets we have to fix. But moving forward, that policy piece is so critical. And we want Minnesota to be at the table creating something that is a policy used as a model by other states.
And
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, I guess the answer is no, because you never answered the question, Mr. Hilgarth. Because the answer is no, you haven't, even in your 8.5 years. Even if you talk about all these other great things, the very basic provision of law in 282, you've never come, or the counties have never come and said this should be a change. So thank you for all the other work, but it is a glaring miss for you not to answer the question, because from my vantage point, that is a part of the challenge. In the 80 years, you nor the counties or others understand or appreciate when you're stripping wealth from the five individuals or five families that you saw your issues more important than theirs. And that's unfortunate from my vantage point. And I wanted to highlight that because when you came up, I wasn't going to say anything, but you talked about the challenges of the county, and we can appreciate those. Our counties work very hard, but when they make a mistake, then they should just say, you know what, in the 80 years that provision has been around, we should have done something. It should not have required the Supreme Court to step in and say, Ms. Tyler, no matter what you've done, to say, oh, we want to say that taxes should be different and we should pay those things. Ms. Tyler should have never had to go through the steps of the judicial process and pay money in order for her rights to be protected. you all did not protect a right. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak, because I do have to
Yes,
run.
Thank you, Senator Champion. And I agree with you that it's they did not come to us and ask for change, but it's also on us because it's our state law that we have left for 80 years. So I think that's appropriate. Your point is right. Thank you. If we can now have the two folks from St. Louis County, Commissioner McDonald and Ms. Marinucci. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner, you're going first, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Paul McDonald. I am a St. Louis County Commissioner. And as Matt Hilgard stated, I am the chair of the AMC Tax Foreclosure, which is the new word now, work group. And this group was composed of many, many county professionals, county commissioners, and a former colleague and trusted member of this body, Senator Senjum, is also on that committee. So he's invested a lot of time in this as well, so and representing Olmsted County. This group, as Mr. Hilgard stated, we've been involved for almost a year now as we move forward on how to solve two things: the constitutionality of the Tyler versus Hennepin and how to address the liability that was created by this decision. AMC has been involved. We've also engaged with Micah and Matt Mossman, and they're totally on board with this as well, as they also support a state-funded solution, as some of you represent people in Micah counties as well. And in this day and age, we all know how difficult it is to get everybody to agree on something. We got all 87 counties to agree that this is the number one priority moving forward. And that made me feel good and made a lot of people in the room feel good. And Senator Hochschild hit the nail on the head. Of all the issues I've worked on in my public service career, this is by far the least attractive, but it is also one of the most consequential as we move forward for every single Minnesotan. And counties have been administering this program process for generations, as we've talked about, 80 plus years. The state has mandated these responsibilities, and counties have assumed the duties of tax delinquency, payment plan administration, blight cleanup, and the ultimate returning of properties to productive use. This process is not cheap or easy, as a number of the people have said today. It's no surprise that the Supreme Court decision caught us off guard, especially after winning at state district court and a court of appeals level. That said, we must respond. We must change our system. We must create a system to resolve past claims in a timely and efficient manner. And it ensures, as Senator Champion stated, interest holders are compensated and without causing undue harm to local communities. Senate File 4936 fulfills this goal. It also represents months of painstaking conversations and mediations between attorneys representing the interest of class action plaintiffs and state and county interest. I'm far from attorney, and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night either, but even as a far-off witness, I can attest that this mediation process was arduous and tedious, but representative of truly the best possible outcome we could have procured with the most reasonable cost to the state. It goes without saying that this settlement would protect our communities back at home. Every single one of your districts, from Ramsey and Scott to Aiken and Grant, have liability based on this Supreme Court ruling. It's also not just counties impacted by this outcome. As mentioned earlier, counties administered this process on behalf of the state, as well as cities, school districts, township, and any other taxing jurisdiction that also stand to be impacted by liabilities associated with this Tyler case. If we fail to bring finality to this liability, we will be causing uncertainty, increased costs, and most importantly, the prospects of financial ruin for communities across the state who have no real ability to respond to the liabilities represented by this case. I'd like to thank my senator, Senator Hochschild, for his leadership on this issue and the time he spent digging into the details. I also want to thank Chair Marty for the interest in our conversations today and the willingness to think about how this complex and technical legal case has real risk for all of our collective communities. Thank you so much for the time and the opportunity to speak today, and I'll turn it over to Julie Marinucci, St. Louis County Director of Land and Minerals.
Thank you, Commissioner McDonald, and Ms. Marinucci, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Julie Marinucci. I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals for St. Louis County and also the Land Commissioner. Our department is tasked with executing Chapter 282 and managing over 900,000 acres of tax forfeited lands. Many of those lands are not recent forfeitures that fall within the look-back period, but are properties that came into our management on behalf of the state of Minnesota back when the law that the Solicitor General referenced back in the 1930s. So these properties were forfeited to the state due to the fact that they had been part of lands that were heavily cut for the virgin timber and then left abandoned, and we had to determine how to determine what the highest and best use of those lands were. And that land base, which now in northeastern Minnesota amounts to about 2.8 million acres, is part of an overall fabric of public lands that has great benefit. But then along with the management of that, and we manage that for timber and supporting our timber industry, we manage that for mining and mineral production, we manage that for recreation, and then we also have the opportunity on that land base when you're looking at carbon sequestration and you're looking at all of the eco-services that those land bases can provide. So we manage that, but then also we manage the annual churn of properties that do come to us through non-payment of taxes, through the current forfeiture process. We manage those properties that come to us in accordance with state statute and in conjunction and under the direction of the Department of Revenue. So they've got significant guidance on how they want us to execute Chapter 282 in the management of those lands, and that tends to fall primarily on those forfeitures and the churn of those forfeitures and how we handle the money and how that money is managed across programmatically within our land base. So I want to just give a little bit of a flavor. In the bill, there's references to conservation land. Those conservation lands are really important. It's really important that we make sure that we understand the difference between conservation and non-conservation. Those are part of the land base that we manage to support our timber industry. And so that piece, I just really would like to express support of the consideration within the bill around that conservation land. I would also say that St. Louis County has worked really hard to take these properties that continue to forfeit, and those that don't fit that conservation definition, those are the ones we work to put back into productive use. But before properties even end up in forfeiture, within our auditor's office and within our land and minerals office, we work very hard to help people stay in their homes, to help people keep their properties. These aren't properties that we want. They're properties that are given to us, and they're usually very complex properties. They're properties that have been abandoned because there's contamination on the site. We had a property in the city of Virginia. It was in a industrial park. It was just a regular looking garage. When you went in there, it had over 200 unmarked barrels, 55 gallon drums of material in there. And that we ended up working with the MPCA on a cleanup project for those types of situations. So these properties, you know, they really are very complex. We don't have good systems and funding in place to help handle those. And good, bad, or otherwise, you know, the state law is held, and we've worked hard to follow that to the letter of the law. St. Louis County is one of the counties that once the litigation And once the Supreme Court ruling came down and there was, we had heard the discussions at the Supreme Court, we said hard time out, like we want to make sure we're handling things in a way that isn't adding to liability for the state and making sure that we are handling things fairly. So I think that Senator Champion had gotten to some of those concerns on making sure that we are being responsible and in the management of those lands. So I'd like to just, the last thing I'd like to touch on is the sale of the properties going forward. So there is the requirement to sell properties that are not conservation and are unsold leading up to this point. St. Louis County is happy to contribute and work hard to get those properties back into productive use and do our part in supporting the state's settlement. It is really a big deal that the $109 million takes care of that obligation and that liability, and we stand ready with our use of online auctions and our robust land system to try and do our best to continue to pay back into that account. So thank you for your time. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you, Ms. Marinucci. With one question, you're a land management office in St. Louis County. How many other counties have land management offices? Probably very few, I assume.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. The up in northeastern Minnesota, there's 16 other counties, I believe, that have land commissioners, designated land commissioners per state statute. They're managing large land bases, tax forfeited land bases. And so there is a handful of us that get together and we work through the management and how we basically apply Chapter 282 to those land bases that we manage.
But you may be better equipped than the other counties to sell properties quickly because you have, or is it, what's the situation for others? Do you know, or maybe that's a question for AMC, but.
Chair, I would say that St. Louis County, good, bad, or otherwise, we do have a higher churn of properties. We get more properties in, therefore we have to get more properties out. From the best I can tell, it's strictly because of our sheer size and the complexity of the land base that we manage. We have everything from rural, small townships, all the way to the city of Duluth. So I think we kind of get a little bit of both. So the smaller counties that tend to be more rural have a lower churn on those properties, less properties that are going forfeit. We get the best of both worlds, which really doesn't necessarily play well in this landscape and with this ruling.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, you talked about the conservation lands. Can you explain that a little bit more? Are those lands you're selling also, or you're just forfeiting them and then trying to hold them? It sounded like you're just trying to hold them and not sell them to the public and get them back in the private rolls. But did I misunderstand that?
Chair, Senator Westrum, the conservation lands are part of a classification system built into Chapter 282. The vast majority of our conservation lands are lands that did forfeit back in, 80 years ago. And those are lands that are held, they're part of a fabric of public lands. Approximately 70% of the lands in northeastern Minnesota are public lands, a mix of federal, state, tax forfeited properties. And so we hold those as part of a land base. And then the more recent forfeitures, those tend to be non-conservation lands because we don't have those large tracts of land that forfeit. But in areas where we may hold something as conservation in recent forfeitures would be areas in coordination with the DNR, there might be mineral potential that we're protecting, or it may provide strategic access to large blocks of public land. So there are scenarios where conservation does make sense. But as a county, we have a vested interest in continuing to put as much property as we can back into private ownership.
Senator Westrum.
And Mr. Chair, and I guess that's my question. I guess from your testimony, it sounded like you were trying to promote keeping as much in conservation land as you can. If some of that land was tax forfeited 80 years ago, and the population of our state has gone up a lot since 80 years ago, so it seems like there'd be an opportunity to get much more of that on the private tax rolls, which would benefit your county as well. And so I guess I'm a little unclear here or confused. If you're promoting for the keeping them on conservation lands, and maybe I should ask this question, do you collect property taxes on the conservation lands at a market rate, or what do you collect on them? I guess if you can embed that into your answer, that would be helpful. But I think I'm hearing from you that you want to keep it in conservation land and not put it on the private tax roll, which would be the opposite of what your county's interest would be as far as getting more private paying tax rolls in letting people enjoy that land. But if you could expand on that, that'd be helpful.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Westrom, the properties that I was referring to in conservation are ones that we have held for a long time. Within this look back period that the Solicitor General had talked about all of the parcels that are available, we've got over 500 parcels just in that look back period going to 2016 ready for sale. And we continue to try and sell as much property as we can. And we have a continuous evaluation of that land base to ensure that we are holding land that has the highest and best use and serve the people of St. Louis County and broadly of the state. We are continuously reviewing that land base to make sure we are maintaining that balance. And our county board is part of the equation on that to make sure that they are keeping and staying focused on that mix of public and private ownership. And to the second part of your question, as it relates to whether or not we collect taxes on that, these properties, the title of these properties are held State of Minnesota in trust for the taxing district, so they are tax exempt.
So, Mr. Chair, just last question. On the 500 parcels you refer to, is that part of the 6,000 number that we're hearing? So is that part of the 6,000?
Chair, Senator, yes, that is part of the 6,000.
And Mr. Chair, just I guess to that point, do we have some other counties with big numbers that make up the 6,000? So maybe half or more of the 6,000 is kind of made up in chunks of several hundred or big allocations. Do you know that answer, or the solicitor?
Senator Westrom, I don't know if somebody in the audience can. Mr. Hilgert, maybe. I think Hennepin and Ramsey, partly because their size and number of properties, they are higher up there too in St. Louis County. And if somebody from Hennepin County here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Rogan. I'm the Assistant County Administrator for Resident Services for Hennepin County and the County Auditor. Senator, in response to your question, I don't have the number for the 6,000, but of the 2,500 that we're talking about that are related to the $109 million, there are about seven counties that have more than 100 properties that make up that total. And for the value, there are 12 counties that make up 75% of the value that's at play. So there's a lot of counties that have very few.
Any Senator Eichhorn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hauschild, for bringing this forward, and thanks for allowing me to become a co-sponsor. This is something that all three of my counties reached out about. I've got two of them that actually gave me some data about what's going on here and really the tough situation they're in. And unfortunately, the scenario we see here is, it seems like it's been a recurring scenario since I've been in the legislature, and you're probably learning as well. There's a lot of things that we've asked counties to do that put them in a bad spot. I mean, this isn't the only time we've been here with counties saying, help us, state. You guys told us to do something, we did it, and now we're in a bind. I'm thinking like the Enbridge lawsuit, how, you know, the assessments were there, and there are other scenarios like that. So, and that's unfortunate that we continue to end up in that situation, but I'm happy you have a fix today. Well, it's not perfect, it's a good fix. One thing that I remember hearing about during a larger pensions discussion was a shared sacrifice, and I think you kind of see that in this proposal. And I'm sure everybody involved would like more their way, but this is a proposal that, you know, strikes a pretty good middle ground, in my opinion. Something everybody can walk away with and say it's not perfect, but you know what? It's pretty good. And so I appreciate the kind of the path you guys took on this, and that's why I was happy you allowed me to sign on. I do appreciate kind of what you alluded to as well, Ms. Mariucci, about not just the financial part, but the opportunity to retain some of those, you know, county-managed lands. I think just the forestry aspect alone, you know, on the county forested lands, I mean, they provide jobs for over 17,000 people in the state, and it's over $1 billion in just, you know, economic impact and what people get in paychecks in that industry. And the counties have done a pretty good job managing those lands, making sure those forests are open for people, but also actually a productive use. So I appreciate that as well. And on the money front, what does it actually mean to like the average individual? My Crow Wing County numbers say that their share is $4.45 million. If they didn't receive the support, it would equate to a 13.5% levy increase at a time when I'm sure everybody has constituents that are screaming about their property taxes already. I don't know of any person that can absorb that. In Itasca County, 29% of the land is private, non-industrial. So if we don't help them, that's that 29% of individuals that are ultimately going to pick up the tab. So again, while not perfect, this is a good bill that will actually help our counties. And the number for Itasca County is about $8 million, so I don't have the percentage levy increase that would equal, but I got to assume it's more than Crow Wing's 13.5%. I don't know what your number is in St. Louis, but I know you guys are in a pretty tough spot as well. But I think it's important for us to find ways to be partners with our counties. I know we get quite frustrated often when the federal government tells us as a state to do something, and I think there have probably been scenarios where we have a state, you know, have maybe done something that some would think is questionable, but we continued to do it because the federal government told us to do so. And while it's easy to beat up on counties, you guys were doing exactly what we told you to do. And, you know, you can't question everything. I mean, you guys wear a lot of hats for us. I mean, there's a lot of bills that we've passed even since I've been here that direct you guys to do something, and, you know, you're happy to be part of the solution. So I'm thankful that we're able to help our counties out today, help individuals that ended up in this bad situation, and we have a way to move forward, and I think that's a good thing. We're recognizing that the problem did exist, and I think this is a good opportunity to fix it. So I'm thankful for this proposal, thankful to the St. Louis County folks for coming to testify, and for the data from my own counties for how important this is. And hopefully we can find ways to keep being partners with our counties, and so if things like this come up, you know, maybe this is kind of a flag for us, as Senator Champion kind of alluded to, that, you know, if there is something else, see something, say something, maybe we can fix a problem before it gets to this point in the future. But thankful for the opportunity to support you today, and hopefully we can get this across the finish line so that you guys get the support you need.
Thank you, Senator Eichhorn. Further discussion. I wanted to quickly...
One additional question.
Go ahead.
Just a question, if I could. I'm curious on the sale part of the land. I got to assume that if we're going to have a fire sale on all this land, so to speak, there's going to be a glut of parcels going up for sale. I assume that is going to potentially hurt the potential sale price. What happens on these parcels if we can't sell it for what an average appraised value would be? I got to assume there's going to be some parcels that are going to end up being less than an appraised value just because there's now going to be more land than would typically be on the market. What happens in those scenarios?
Senator Hochschild or Ms. Marianucci, whichever, whoever wants to go.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Eichhorn. In our read of the proposed language, it says that they must be sold for the appraised value. St. Louis County uses the estimated market value as generated by the assessor's office for that number. And so what we would do as we hold those properties longer, and those are going to be your more, again, complicated properties. They're going to be blighted properties, difficult, small, odd-shaped properties. We would then, our expectation, assuming things carry as they're written, we would then go back to our assessors and say, is this still the right number? It hasn't sold, is it still the right number? And if they make the determination through the rules and guidelines that they've got, then we would be able to use that to readjust the price as we move forward. Because again, we have the same vested interest in getting those properties back into private hands.
Mr. Chair, so the only real mechanism to get a price lowered is going out to reassess it if it sits there and doesn't sell. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a better way to do that. Maybe there is. I got to assume that you're going to be sitting on some land longer than you'd probably like, because as you alluded to, it is better if it's back on the tax roll. So I don't know if there's a better way to do that. Certainly would be open to discussions from the counties on that, but it'd be nice if you guys had a pinch more flexibility on that front.
Thank you. Yes, and if, as you said, Senator Eichhorn, if anybody has suggestions on that from the counties, we welcome that. Ms. Stengel, you wanted to comment on that?
Senator Marty and Senator Eichhorn, if you look at lines 2.3 to 2.5 of the A9 amendment, it references what will happen to unsold property after 2029, and it must be continued to be managed under the laws governing tax forfeited lands until they're disposed.
So they would continue after they have 4 years to try and sell them for this, and the proceeds would be three quarters of the proceeds would be going to state and so on. And as far as the we do not have a fiscal note on this, and they're struggling to get one because the state doesn't have all the values. But the estimates, and I assume this was, I think it was partly Hennepin County who helped put this together, was 26.7 million that we would get back over this next couple years or so. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, yes. The information that we have is what we've collected from all of the counties. So there's only about 110 of these properties that are in Hennepin County, but as part of the settlement, we have contacted all of the counties to collect the data, to collect the estimated market value for each one of the properties that are in inventory. And as you alluded to, the overall estimated market value, the total value for all of those properties is just north of $70 million. But based on what we know, the estimated market value, as Ms. Marinucci just said, we do an appraisal when we're getting ready to sell, and usually that's lower than what the estimated market value is. And so the number that you reference of $26.7 million is taking 50% of the $71 million and then applying the three quarters to the state.
Okay, and how many of these properties, since you may be the best one to guess this because you've gathered all the state data, how many of the properties are just not going to sell because nobody wants them kind of thing? Is that a significant number of them, or hard to say?
Mr. Chair, it's difficult to say because I don't really have a sense of what's happening in the other 86 counties. I can tell you that more than 65% of the properties that are in this pool forfeited in the last 4 years, and there's that usually means the properties that have sold or that sell usually the ones that are more recent. We have some in Hennepin County since our period goes further back that go back to 2012. There's eight properties in there. I think those eight properties are remnants and other parts that nobody wants to purchase, and that those are going to be very hard to sell, but they're also the lowest value. So it's very hard to say, but I think that there is a big chunk of properties that are marketable, that will be sold because they forfeited in the last 4 years, and there'll be ones that counties will be able to sell at auction.
And you think that 50% discount rate is, we have a reasonably good expectation of getting somewhere near that 26?
Mr. Chair, I would say that's right. Reasonably good expectation. I would stand by that. It's very hard to judge 2,500 properties when we don't have a sense of that. But based on what we were looking at in kind of when we were negotiating the settlement, I think that this is a very reasonable amount. And as the Solicitor General said, I believe that it will raise between $20 and $30 million over the 4 year period.
Okay. And one final question, I'm not sure if you're the one to answer it, but of the $109 million that goes out to the claims administrator, is that something that all of that's likely to be paid out, or we don't know?
Mr. Chair, we don't know. It depends on what the how many of the 6,000 people who may have a surplus were able to reach, what those values are, and whether or not the $109 million we would have to use all of that or not. I can tell you that in the bill here, that if it's not used, it does revert back to the state.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Pratt, and we want to keep moving. We have two other bills I'd like to get to quickly, and Senator.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And you touched on the on the question I had regarding the fiscal note, understanding we don't have one available now. I wanted to clarify that, Senator Hochschild, maybe you can answer this. The agency has agreed to absorb the cost for administering this program, so all the proceeds will be going to the plaintiffs, the required the interest that's accrued over that period of time, as well as the mandatory court costs we're required to cover, and I'm presuming the cost of the administrator, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, that's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Pratt.
Mr. Chair, I would ask you and Senator Murphy as Majority Leader, if that significantly changes, if we find that there's an agency cost that's coming through, if we find that there's a broad discrepancy between our working knowledge today and what comes back in the fiscal note, do I have both of your commitments that we would refer this back to finance for discussion?
If the fiscal note comes significantly lower, I think we have to resolve that one way or another, and I think I'll talk with you and discuss whether it should come back to finance or how, because I have a feeling, I mean, the House has got the same thing, and Mr. Nauman, you look like you want to say something on this too.
Mr. Chair, I'm only waiting to see where this goes.
Go ahead, Senator. And Mr. Pratt. Chair, I'm specifically interested in any costs that aren't going to the plaintiffs or the costs that we already know to make sure that there's no administrative cost that's being absorbed.
So, Mr. Chair,
out of this settlement.
I apologize, Senator Pratt. Mr. Chair, maybe this is a good point for me to jump in. If we take a look at the A9 amendment and the appropriation language on line 2.17 through 2.21, what I can tell you, irrespective of the fiscal note, and where that discussion is going, is that there is no appropriation authority here for the agency to retain dollars for the purposes of administration. So in other words, the appropriation is made to the Commissioner of Management and Budget to make payments to the claim administrator under the terms of the settlement. That's it.
They are not allowed, they have no access to the $109 million other than to pass it on.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to make sure that if there is any change to the fiscal note that would require us to pay any of those monies, that it come back to finance.
If they start asking us for paying, if they start taking it, we will be back at this.
I'm just asking for a commitment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we will see that. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Council talked about the process that will go into place after 2029. I don't know if you can explain that a little bit more. Does that give more flexibility? Senator Eichhorn brought up, I think, another valuable point. We aren't giving flexibility on properties that might not be on the mark with the appraised value, but yet you're going to still be holding them. I'm not clear on what the process is after 2029. If Council can either explain that, and then I have a follow-up, or one of the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to answer?
Go ahead.
Senator's question. Senator, right now we hold the lands on behalf of the state, and the counties manage them. And after 2029, the ones that we haven't sold, we will continue to hold and manage that way, as will likely we will have other properties that go through a tax forfeiture process, a revised tax forfeiture process, when the policy bill comes through from 2024 going forward. So they'll be managed the same way that we will be managing other tax forfeited properties.
And so, Mr. Chair, do you have flexibility besides just what somebody says was the appraised value if a property doesn't sell? And what do you do to have that flexibility? And I guess my concern is what Senator Eichhorn raised, that the appraised value, it doesn't always hit the mark. And what do we have in place for the counties to do either a reverse auction and find the real market value at the time, or or start low and see how much somebody will bid it up, like a normal auction? Do you have those processes in place? I'm not clear on that. It sounds to me like you're stuck with an appraised value, and then you got to go back through the whole evaluation of coming up with another appraised value if the assessors look at it. And what if they miss it again? Why not just go to the market? And that's how the market real estate goes up or down. The last few years, what they offer it for usually is lower than what it ends up for selling for. Most of the times in the real estate market, it probably sells for less than what somebody's asking for it. Explain that a little bit, because it doesn't look clear to me that this bill has got that flexibility in it.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator, just building off of what Ms. Marinucci said, the appraised value, we set the appraised value. It's actually, the statute lays out a process for that. It's done through the county board, and in Hennepin County and most counties, it gets then delegated down to staff to set the appraised value. So we have flexibility to set the appraised value along the lines of what you just described, which is we've now tried a couple of times, and now we actually have to look and say, whatever an appraiser is looking at isn't the right number. We need to set it at a number that's going to have the property sell. And there are often times where we try to sell to an adjoining party, an adjoining property, because that's the only person who would be interested in it. So we do have the flexibility in the current statute right now to adjust that appraised value to make sure that we can sell the property and that we're not forever holding on to property because of the appraisal can't get the number right.
Senator Pratt, before we move further, I wanted to make sure clear to your point about if anybody's taking out money for the $109 million all goes to the courts, the claim administrator, but I believe the settlement, which we could have Ms. Kramer come if you want, but some of that will go to attorney fees and other things, but that's the court's decision. The settlement would call for us to pay $109 million, and MMB does not get any of that $9 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just asking for your commitment that if there's a significant change or if there's a requested additional appropriation, that it come back to finance.
We will. Is there further discussion? If not, Senator Eichhorn moves Senate File 4936 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just final remarks. Why we're moving this separate from the other fixes, I think, is not prudent. I think we should know what the whole solution is going to do to fix this when we're talking $109 million. That's pretty important. We've got the purse strings here. With just a sort of promise that we'll try to fix the rest, and if it doesn't happen this year, we'll do it next year. And Mr. Chair, I just think that's irresponsible. I think we should be holding this till we have a better knowledge of the whole fix. And Senator Hochschild should either incorporate the fix into this, or his bill should be incorporated into Senator whoever's handling the other part of it. It doesn't make sense to send this kind of money out without fixing the whole problem here. And the discussion has been pretty clear that there's a lot of problems to fix. And putting the money ahead of the cart ahead of the horse is what we're really doing here with this kind of money. And no fiscal note. This is not very precedented for this committee to be sending stuff out with this kind of money. Fiscal note, still not done. The solution and the fix for the big problem, still not done. So, Mr. Chair, I just would ask you to consider holding this up till we can get the fix. And I'll guarantee you that's going to get the fix done the fastest. And in a week or two, you'll have a lot of people scurrying around to make sure this fix is done the right way for the property tax owners. And I just think this is premature and not appropriate to be sending out with this many problems and questions and unanswered fixes that we know need to be made.
Senator Westrom, I will say that this bill is to deal with some unconstitutional behavior that we had under the previous state law This is dealing with that's settling those past claims. Counties are not selling property until they have clarification on what is a fair constitutional process for doing it. And we have to do that moving forward, and that's a very important issue. But with that, this is to settle past claims against the state. It is a separate but very related issue. Senator Murphy moved, or Senator Eichhorn moved Senate File 4936 be, as amended, be recommended pass. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hochschild and Eichhorn and St. Louis County and Hennepin County and counties and the Attorney General's office. Thank you all. Now we're going to try and, I'm told I'm never supposed to say bills are quick bills because that always means they're not. So I'm going to say these are going to be very slow, long bills. We'll start with Senator McEwen's very slow, long bill that I hope isn't too slow. Welcome to the Senate Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 4745.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I am hoping that this one will be an easy one for you. This is Senate File 4745. This is the bill that includes recommendations made by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council for amendments to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 176. I am one of four legislative liaisons assigned to the council, along with Senator Utke, Representative Wolgamont, and Representative McDonald. The Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, as many of you know, is a statutory labor employer council that negotiates reforms to the workers' compensation system before recommending a consensus bill to the legislature, the goal of which is to improve the workers' compensation process for businesses and injured workers. The language before you was unanimously approved by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council and includes proposals from the council's labor and business caucuses, the workers' compensation bar, the Department of Labor and Industry, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. It contains 50 sections with amendments to Chapter 176, many of which are technical or cleanup provisions. And I do have along with me today Assistant Commissioner Jessica Stimmick, who is available for any questions, technical questions you may have about the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Commissioner Mangley here for questions.
Yes, that's like true. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Nauman, you want to walk through the fiscal note quickly?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note is in your packet. There are no general fund revenues associated with this bill. There is the Department of Labor and Industry is assuming a slightly higher expense associated with some increased penalty violations. The cost is about $6,000, a little bit less than $6,000 a year, and that's offset by the revenue.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, maybe the author could just go through the higher penalty changes that are in the bill and a few of the other highlights.
Maybe you are.
Mr.
Asked.
Chair,
no, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. Was that for me, Senator Westrom, or my apologies?
Ms. Stimmick, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the question. There are two penalty provisions. One increases the penalty amount from $1,000 to $2,500 when an insurer has not given proper notice to an injured worker that they are going to discontinue benefits or have not recommenced payment of benefits after receiving an order from a judge in a timely manner. So it's really to just deter the conduct, and $1,000 is pretty low for that conduct. The other penalty is, it's actually new. We had language last year that passed really creating a fee schedule for electronic medical records, and we've had some issues with compliance, but without clear penalty authority. So this is just giving the commissioner authority to issue a penalty of $500 for failure to comply with that language.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, so this shows a $6,000 a year savings or benefit back to the department. So the department keeps these penalties? They're not remitted back to the claimant?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. It goes to the assigned risk safety account.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the rationale for increasing the penalty?
The rationale for increasing the penalty in 238 is really to deter the conduct. We think that it's particularly egregious if carriers aren't recommencing benefits to injured workers. These are weekly benefits. Or if they're failing to give the injured worker notice that they're going to discontinue benefits.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. So how does the department use these funds? Are there costs associated with these penalties that need to be offset, or is this just additional revenue coming to the agency?
Chair, Senator Pratt, thank you for your question. The assigned risk safety account is actually a fund that employers can access for safety programs. So that is where that additional revenue goes. That's what the assigned risk safety account is used for.
Senator Pratt. Okay, no further questions. Senator, is there any further discussion of Senate File 4745? If not, Senator Friends, move Senate File 4745 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator McEwen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Finally, we have Senator Pappas, the Capital Projects Appropriations Modifications, and you have an A9 amendment to this. Senator Pappas moves the A9 amendment to this, and maybe you could start by, before we adopt the amendment, which isn't technically an author's amendment, but given the nature of the process in which everybody, all four caucuses and everybody signed off.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 4307 with the amendment modifies the language of 62 separate capital appropriations made by the legislature in previous years, mostly 2023, but some go back a little farther. They include language changes, appropriation extensions, or both. They modify both the cash appropriations and the general obligation bond. So because of that, they require a 3/5 vote. So because of that, in addition, all of these modifications, so there's no additional money spent, they're all non-controversial. They've all been reviewed by the four caucus leaders and the staff and agreed to. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would move the A9 amendment.
Senator Pappas moves the A9 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Aye. Ms. James, did you want to...
Mr. Chairman, you said you did not want us to go through each section.
If members of the committee want to, we could go
through
every one of them.
Ms. James is here if there's any questions.
I'm assuming members do not, since it's been approved by... It's similar to the revisor's bill, which we have all the sign-offs. Okay.
Right.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 4745? If not, 4307. Senate File 4307, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas and Ms. James.
Exactly.
And with that, this committee is done for the day. And as I said, we'll be up on Tuesday of next week. We have Senator Friends, who goes the only one I'm aware of, which is the energy regulatory changes. And next Wednesday and Thursday, we are, Senate is off for Eid, so we are not meeting those 2 days. And the following week, we will be working very quickly with the budget bills coming in. So next week it's only on Tuesday. With that, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we discussed a bill that's sitting in committee. I'm hoping we can add that to the schedule on Tuesday as well.
Thank you. With that, no further business. This committee is adjourned.